Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello and thank you for joining us on Living History. Today we're heading back to a topic that really fascinates me, the Western Front, particularly the Australians on the Western Front. But we're telling a story here that has a lot of Australian connections and just a really famous story of the First World War, one of the most famous stories of the First World War. It's the story of the fighter ace, the Red Baron. And there's a lot of myth about this story. There's, it's one of the most controversial and argued stories of the First World War. So I'm looking forward to exploring it in detail. And to help me do that is someone who's been on the podcast several times before. It's Dr. Aaron Pegram from the Australian War Memorial. Aaron, thanks for joining us again.
Matt, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be on the podcast yet again. I think last time that we spoke, I said you must be scraping the bottom of the barrel if you're coming back to me for yet another dose of history. But here we are talking about Manfred von Richthofen, the so-called Red Baron.
Well, I certainly appreciate your modesty, mate, but I can say that the podcasts we've done in the past have been some of the most popular. So obviously you know your stuff, and that's why you're doing such a good job at the War Memorial. People love hearing what you're talking about. But the Red Baron today is going to be a good topic. We haven't really talked much about the air war on Living History, and I don't think we've done anything on the Red Baron, so I'm looking forward to getting into this. And what I wanted to do, the reason I asked you to come on, is that the Australian War Memorial has some wonderful items associated with the Red Baron. So I thought we could tell the story of Richthofen, the Red Baron, through some of those wonderful objects that you have there at the Australian War Memorial.
Indeed. I don't think there's probably a more famous personality from the First World War as Manfred von Richthofen, who had the distinction of being the leading fighter ace of the First World War, not just for the Germans, but of the entire First World War. He had 80 confirmed kills to his name, predominantly flying on the Western Front between 1916 to 1918. Richthofen was the sort of the German scourge of the skies for the Allied forces during that period of time and seemed invincible. But he had the misfortune of being brought down by ground fire and crashing in Australian lines where on the junction between the 3rd and 4th Australian Divisions, who at that time were occupying positions around Morlancourt Ridge, just outside of Corby, and the Australians recognizing the distinctive red Fokker triplane, as Richthofen has been famously associated with, and stripped it for souvenirs. Everything from personal effects on Richthofen's body through to pieces of the aircraft itself. Though, of course, there's collections relating to Richthofen throughout the world, but the memorial has probably one of the largest collections of items relating to Richthofen's death. And I think that's really important because there's much more to the man than just his final flight, although there has been much ink spilt debating, of course, over the last 100 years who killed Richthofen. We'll get into that later on into the podcast. But of course, the memorial has quite a number of objects which we will discuss as our chat unfolds.
Tell me, as a historian, mate, these iconic chapters of history, the one everyone wants to talk about, everyone's heard of the Red Baron. Do you embrace those stories as a historian and enjoy the fact that you get to explore more angles of them? Or does it get frustrating and boring that you just have to roll out the same old stories?
It's a really good question. I mean, as a professional military historian, I think every historian worth his or her salt is trained in questioning those accepted myths and stereotypes. And I have a sort of a natural inclination to sort of steer away from the time-honored, cherished stories that sort of get trotted out every now and again. And in order to, I guess, trying to find a new angle in some of these stories, I think it's healthy that we start challenging what we assume to be correct. I naturally like to. I think that in relation to Richthofen, I think his confirmed kills, those 80 confirmed kills, the Red Fokker triplane, and the man himself has sort of all become larger than the myth has become larger than the man that the Richthofen ultimately was. So much so that there's some aspects of Richthofen's story that we don't hear so much about. The fact that he may have been suffering a traumatic brain injury during the time of his final flight, or the fact that one of his 80 kills was an Australian by the name of Jack Hay of Number 40 Squadron, Royal Flying Corps. Some of those unknown or lesser known aspects of Richthofen's story, I think, is fascinating. Whilst looking into Richthofen's story, I think it was interesting to point out that during the war years, he wasn't actually known as the Red Baron. In Germany, towards the latter stages of 1917, he was known as he'd published a memoir during a period of leave. He was Der Rote Kampfflieger.
The French call him Diable Rouge,
or the red devil, and to the British at the time, he was the red pirate. I think that's really quite interesting that this guy who painted his aircraft bright red to sort of fuel his own notoriety had a number of different names, but it seems that the Red Baron, which we know him through today, and also through that really horrible 1960s pop song, and then also his reference there in Snoopy. That's all a post-war construction. So I like to think that just by studying Richthofen just a little bit, we sort of unpeeled some of the layers of myth to get to the heart of what the story actually was.
Some of those popular culture references, I think I should do a whole podcast just on those at some stage, because I did a Gallipoli podcast recently, and I realized as I was discussing it with the historian and these elements of Gallipoli, I realized how much of the popular story, even my own initial understanding of Gallipoli, was drawn from the 1981 film with Mel Gibson. And you'd mentioned a couple of things where the Red Baron is referred to, you know, Snoopy and the song from the 60s. I mean, I think a lot of what we know collectively about these famous chapters of history are actually drawn a lot from these popular culture references. Is that something that comes into your work as a historian? Do you have to weigh up public perception of the things they're seeing on TV and movies in comparison to what they should be reading in history books? Does that weigh into your world as a historian, or are you simply reading archives and primary sources and forming good opinions?
The answer to that question is both, because historians always working in archives, looking at primary source material and secondary source material, trying to get to the kernel of what the actual story actually was. But where historians probably differ from journalists, perhaps we can probably borrow or lend some credibility from journalists is the fact of making stories relatable to the average public. I think historians sometimes get so bogged down into the minutiae and academia that they lose contact with the story that they're trying to communicate and their audience. There's no point writing a book that's in dense historical scholarship that's catered for a readership of about three people within the relevant field. I think the historians can make their stories relatable by communicating in relatively simple, easy communicative devices, talking on podcasts, for example, publishing more popular books, and also using those popular myths and stereotypes that people are more familiar with, and use that as a hook or a springboard to then launch into aspects of the past which may or may not be the way in which people most popularly remember them. And so Richthofen's a classic example. I'll have to say with the Snoopy appearances of Snoopy and also that gaudy 1960 song of the Red Baron, I mean, it makes light of the fact of Richthofen and his notoriety in the fighting on the Western Front. But it also masks the harsh reality of aspects of his personality personality, and also just how devastating he was for Allied pilots flying over the Western Front. I alluded to the story of an Australian flying in No. 40 Squadron who was Richthofen's 17th victim. His name was John Hay, Jack Hay from Double Bay in Sydney. He went to Shaw, Sydney Church of England Grammar School, and like so many men of a relatively affluent background in Australia at that time, went over to England to gain his pilot wings and serve in the Royal Flying Corps, which he does in June 1916. And he's flying FE-8 Pusher Scouts over the Arras sector in early 1917. Number 40 Squadron engages in a duel with members of Richthofen's Jasta over Lens. And Hay is felled by Richthofen's machine. Richthofen engages Hay at about a distance of about 50 metres. This is actually the first time that Richthofen's flying in an all-red Albatross aircraft. In fact, most of Richthofen's kills are accredited to him in an Albatross D2, which Richthofen is flying on this occasion. The very first time the Red Baron is flying in an all-red aircraft. Hay's aircraft catches a light, and because the Royal Flying Corps doesn't equip its pilots with parachutes at that time, fearing that perhaps they may become less aggressive in combat or not bring back their aircraft, Hay is forced to abandon his aircraft midair at about 500 feet or 500 meters. And so Jack Hay, at the age of 27, falls to his death. His body is recovered by Canadian troops who ultimately write to Hay's parents in Sydney. And one of them says, "I had to bring him in alive or dead. He put up such a magnificent fight." And some of the items that we have in the memorial's collection is one of the temporary grave markers from Lieutenant John Hay. He's buried at a cemetery, at Air Communal Cemetery, not too far away where his aircraft was brought down. And we have his pilot brevet wings. We have some small items from him. But of course, the brevet wings were on him when he ultimately met his end in 1917.
You tell that story, Aaron, and it just reiterates there's a massive contrast with the air war. We're so fascinated with the air war in the First World War, the Knights of the Air, the gallantry of the Red Baron. But there's such a savagery to it, the idea of going up in a flimsy cloth and timber plane and raking each other's aircraft up with machine gun bullets, petrol catching a light, people falling to their deaths without parachutes. There's a horrific element to this fighting, and the stress the pilots must have been under. You know, I think the air war in the First World War sums up that idea that it's you know, hours of boredom and minutes of terror is the definition of warfare, and it just must have been horrific. I mean, the movie in the aircraft hall at the Australian War Memorial that Peter Jackson put together shows that brilliantly, the combat. Just the first time I saw that many years ago, I was surprised by how little I understood about the barbarity of the air war. Is that something that you try to address in these stories of Richthofen and the air war?
Yeah, I think so. It's not just Richthofen in the air war, but I think the realities of air combat on the Western Front. And it wasn't just about these gentlemen who took to the skies and, you know, fought gallantly between 9 to 5 and then clocked off and had beers in the mess afterwards. There is a grim reality to combat in the Western Front or air combat during this particular time. Further to, I'll just say two more things about Jack Hay. Many people who are listening from Australia will know of Hay in the Riverina region of New South Wales, and that's the same family we're talking about. Jack Hay's parents and his family had been prominent grazing families in the Riverina, had established a significant grazing property in Hay, New South Wales. And Matt, you're from that area. You're very familiar, probably, with the town there. But then also too, talking about the horrible realities of that air combat. Richthofen, in his memoir Der Rote Kampfflieger, he specifically makes mention of having reoccurring nightmares of the very first Englishman he saw plummeting from the sky. And it wasn't so much that seeing that it was being inflicted, he had done that himself. It was the realization that perhaps may have ultimately occurred to him at some point.
It seems from the research I've done into the flyers of the First World War that this stress, more than just stress, a mind-altering traumatic stress situation was part and parcel of being a pilot. Just the accounts you read of their drinking, their nightmares, it just seems like all pervasive in these accounts of these airmen. Is that something you've come across in your research into the airmen of the First World War?
Yeah, look, my research into the airmen of the First World War has always been fairly limited and targeted for relevant articles or displays. But I think a really good book that perhaps harnesses this is Michael Malkintine's excellent book, Fire in the Sky, which looks at the operations of the Australian Flying Corps in Sinai and Palestine, and then also the fighter and reconnaissance squadrons that are operating on the Western Front. And you're dead right. I mean, pilots themselves encounter what we would combat stress and combat strain, not necessarily of engaging the enemy in the skies over the Western Front, but then also the dangers and perils of flying at that time. As you said, aircraft are made of either doped linen and fabric, tension cables or bits of plywood, and they're often parachutes. They're invented, but they're so large and cumbersome that they ultimately affect the power to weight ratio within the aircraft at that time. I mean, these aircraft at the start of the war, aviation was still in its infancy. It was manned aerial aviation had only been 7 years old. But by the end of the war, there's at least squadrons of aircraft. This rapid development of aircraft technological development, where pilots are equipped with parachutes, that we now have aircraft that have the ability to fire through the propeller, then through the use of an interrupter gear. Then we also see the first monoplane. So no longer the aircraft, two or three wings, that we actually start to see the first monoplanes, or even the first steel-skinned aircraft. So there's a rapid development there through the cumbersome lessons and losses of aviation and the air war over the Western Front.
We'll get specifically to the Red Baron in a minute, which is the reason we're here. But just on that subject, it's something that comes up time and time again with the First World War. We think of the Second World War as huge technological advancements. We saw jet engines and all of the technology, the atomic bomb, everything that developed during the Second World War. But I think the First World War was an extraordinary time of development. We're only talking a decade or so. At the start of the war, it had only been slightly over a decade since the Wright brothers had the first powered flight. And the advancement of aircraft, I mean, nothing sums up the technological advancements during the First World War like the development of aircraft. From the flimsy planes that were flying in 1914 compared to what we were seeing over the skies in 1918, just extraordinary.
Absolutely, and that's not just specific to the air war on the Western Front. I mean, that's just combat more generally during the First World War, where we have technological advances in aircraft. We see our first tanks. We also see the development in weapons such as poisonous gas, for example, and the various countermeasures. We see the rapid advances within medicine. The first plastic surgery cases are developed during the First World War. So with war comes this great technological leap and advancement, but then also too the process works the opposite way, particularly for frontline soldiers who engage in combat on the Western Front. Yes, they have machine guns that are now portable and light and then can be used as squad infantry weapons. Yes, they have smokeless powder in their rifles and artillery pieces, but then also too you've got soldiers who are equipped with helmets and armor and tank crews are wearing visors with chainmail. And during trench raids, for example, soldiers are going into combat armed with clubs and daggers. So it's almost as if these are weapons that have that revolve back down into the Middle Ages as well. So on one hand, that technological advancement sort of moves forward into the future, but then also too for your frontline soldier, and perhaps even sometimes too for your airman, that process of evolution goes back the opposite direction.
Well, let's talk about the Red Baron. What I'd like is, can you give a very brief, just in a couple of minutes, just an overview of his career? Because as you said quite astutely at the top of the interview that too much has been said about his death and his last couple of flights. Let's talk about the Red Baron as a man and what led to his, well, fame. I mean, he was a famous flyer in his time. Let's talk about his story.
History loves these characters who have these excellent rags to riches stories, and I can assure you that Richthofen is not one of them. This is a guy who's born into a very wealthy aristocratic family in Germany, in Lower Saxony, called a little town called Breslau, which is now part of Poland, in May 1892. And that family expected the men of that family to serve in the Imperial German Army with distinction. Now, as a kid, Richthofen enjoys the usual pursuits as children of his background and ilk did at that time. He enjoys gymnastics and horseback riding, hunting wild boar and elk and deer and birds. And in fact, the family manor was decorated with many of these different trophies that were on display throughout the house. Eventually, the family moved to a place called Schniedwitz, where Richthofen attended school until about 1903. And he enters the Prussian military school at Wallstadt at the age of 11. Now, could you imagine that you beginning your military career in a school at the age of 11? I mean, it's a completely different world to, I think, that what you and I and most of the listeners that we who are listening to the podcast have grown up with.
Even military people, even people who serve in the military would never be expecting to do so at age 11.
No, that's right. I mean, this is a military school, and this is a school that's designed to groom these children into a military career, into a proud and established military career, into the Imperial German Army. So Richthofen completes his training in 1911, and whereupon he's commissioned into a very highfalutin and very distinguished Uhlan regiment. By the outbreak of war in 1914, he's a young lieutenant in what is probably the most prestigious cavalry regiment at the outbreak of the First World War. So he's part of that Prussian aristocracy. He's very much of the school where he's gone to the right school, he's entered the right unit, and he's at the top of his game, even as a young man at the outbreak of war. This regiment, Richthofen's regiment, is usually a reconnaissance regiment. This is the German equivalent of the cavalry, primarily used in a reconnaissance role, which is what they do in Russia, in France, in Belgium during the very opening early engagements of the war. But believe it or not, horseback reconnaissance has little place on the Western Front once the stalemate sort of settles through that sort of first winter of 1914-1915. And the regiment becomes dismounted, and somewhat ignominiously, its troops, who have come from all these prestigious families, are relegated to dispatch runners, field telephone operators, and all this sort of stuff. So Richthofen is somewhat disappointed by the reduced prospects of leading his men into combat in this way, and so he transfers to the Fliegertruppen, which is the German army's air service branch at that time, and around May 1915. And he cuts his teeth after his flight training as an observer flying reconnaissance aircraft, twin-seater reconnaissance aircraft over on the Western Front. It's very fortunate. Oh, then that regiment then goes off, and Richthofen goes and sees a small period of service at the carrier pigeon section at Ostend in Belgium. And it's around this time that Richthofen has this sort of brief and surprising encounter with the leading German airman of this time, Oswald Bolker, who inspires Richthofen to carry out pilot training and become a fighter pilot, which he ultimately does. Richthofen becomes a pilot, and he gets posted to Kampfgeschwader II, which is a fighter squadron number 2, and initially starts flying Albatross C-2 twin-seater reconnaissance aircraft. And he probably does this against the French over Verdun. And it's around this time that Richthofen scores his first of 80, or his first aerial victory. He shoots down a Nieuport scout over Verdun in April 1916, although because the aircraft crashed over French lines, it could not be confirmed. It's actually uncredited to Richthofen's name. Richthofen again crosses paths with Oswald Bolker, who at that time in August 1916 was actually searching for promising young fighter pilots or pilots to join Jaster 2, which is Bolker's fighter squadron wants to find fit, young, capable young pilots as a premier fighter squadron at Wilu on the Somme front, which is not too far away from Courcelette behind Pozières. And there Richthofen becomes a sort of a dedicated student of what they refer to as dicta bulka, which is the list of fundamental aerial maneuvers promulgated by Bulka as the axioms of pilot success. These are just basically some very basic tenets about what pilots should and shouldn't do in the midst of aerial combat, developed by Bulka himself, who at this point in time had been awarded the Porte Mérite, the Blue Max, the Germany's highest honor for bravery, had at least 30 kills to his credit, flying Fokker Eindeckers, the first sort of monoplane employed by the German air service at that time. And also Richthofen scores his first victory, you know, applying these lessons. He flying an Albatross D2 on the 17th of September 1916, he brings down a British FE-2B pusher scout of number 11 Squadron Royal Flying Corps over a place called Villepuy. So this is kind of the first sort of iteration of where Richthofen comes from. He's, like I said, he's no rags from riches story. He's from a wealthy family. He finds his way into the war via a very prestigious unit. And it's almost as if the war has transformed him into a fighter pilot. And in this, at this stage, Richthofen is no different from any of the fighter pilots that are in the German air service around this time. But it's round on the Somme front as the fighting of the Somme and that Somme winter abates into the Battle of Arras, where Richthofen starts to make his name. I have to say, Richthofen was present when Bulka was involved in a mid-air collision with a fellow pilot from Yasta 2 that ultimately killed him. And tragic though that was for the squadron and for the Imperial, or for Imperial Germany more broadly, Bulka's death did little to impair Richthofen's success, because within 3 months, Richthofen's tally stood at 15 victories. I mean, this is a time, this is a period of the war where the Germans are starting to gain an aerial ascendancy over their front, and certainly Richthofen's 80 kills are sort of nice and neatly chunked up into these periods where Richthofen, where the Germans have air superiority. And Richthofen also doesn't sort of engage himself into a fight that he knows that he can't win. So it's about positioning and putting yourself into the right situation before engaging. British aircraft at this time, they were referred to as pushers. So it's ostensibly a bathtub fitted to a biplane where the propeller is at the back of the pilot. And that enables the pilot to fire a machine gun unimpeded through the front there. Because at this time, I think the RSC didn't actually have interrupter gears. So they couldn't actually have the ability to fire through their propellers. The Germans had aircraft such as the Albatross D2 at this time, which is ostensibly a machine gun platform that had interrupter gears. All the pilot had to do was adjust the nose towards its target and ultimately fire its twin MG-08 machine guns towards the target. And ultimately, that's what happened. And that's how Richthofen racked up his first 15 victories.
We should point out at this stage, Aaron, that to be an ace of the First World War meant you needed 5 victories. So it was obviously, considering and when you think about it, shooting, going up and shooting.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Down 5 enemy planes. That's a huge achievement at this stage, given the technology, given the skills of the pilots, the nature of the fighting. To score 5 kills was an extraordinary achievement, which is why to be considered an ace, you had to have at least 5 victories. We're talking here about Richthofen relatively early in his career with 15 and then ultimately ending up with 80. It does show an extraordinary ability in the air, doesn't it?
Without a doubt. And I mean, Richthofen is very keen and very quick to adapt to this. And I think a lot of that comes back down to Bulka and those axioms of pilot success. But then also too, I mean, it's no, it's no different from Richthofen and his you know, his pastimes when he was growing up as a child. I mean, this is a guy who's quite used to hunting. He's just as familiar as stalking deer through the forest of Schneidwitz as he is in an aircraft over the Western Front. And then certainly, obviously, those trophies that are adorning the walls of the family manor, of course, become there's a somewhat similar transition as well. Not long after he racks up those 15 kills, Richthofen brings down the leading British fighter ace of the war at this time, Major Lanno Hawker of No. 24 Squadron, who had been awarded the Victoria Cross in 1915. Hawker and Richthofen had engaged in a 30-minute duel over the Somme front, which ended when Hawker's DH2 was trailed by Richthofen. Richthofen managed to get off a fatal burst that ultimately led with Hawker being shot in the back of the head. Now, we talked about the sort of saintly, knightly, gentlemanly conduct of the war. The Germans did bury Lanno Hawker, although his grave has now been he remains missing. But Lanno Hawker. Richthofen did not attend Hawker's funeral because Richthofen thought it was bad taste for the hunt to be at the gravesite of the victim. And it's quite interesting in the fact that Richthofen talks about hunters and victims in this kind of way. But Richthofen did actually take Hawker's Lewis gun as a trophy, and he hung it above his door to his quarters. And from that point on, Richthofen kept souvenirs of the men and the machines that he had brought down over German lines, to the point where he had a jeweler in Breslau in Germany make silver cups to celebrate each of his victories. And each one of them was inscribed with the date of the engagement, the type of the aircraft, and of his 80 victories, 60 of such cups were made, little victory cups. Until the paucity of silver in Germany at that time sort of prevented more cups from being made. And Richthofen refused to have more of those cups made out of lesser metals because, he thought he was better than that. Interestingly enough, the Amaka Aviation Museum in New Zealand, this is the Peter Jackson inspired museum or funded museum that's in New Zealand, has a small collection of some of those cups purporting to be from Richthofen's, including number 11 of that of Lanno Hawker.
What do you think Richthofen was like as a man? Is he someone that if we could teleport him through time and space, you'd want to sit down and have a beer with today? He sounds aristocratic. He sounds removed from the common man. What does your research tell you he was like as a person?
I don't think he would have been an easy person to sit down and have a conversation with. I think he would have been arrogant, aloof. I think at the end of the day, I think he was a remarkable fighter pilot, but I think also too what fuels his professionalism, I guess, is that sense of nobility, the fact that he's from an aristocratic background, but then also too, the fact that he sees himself as a hunter. He's very much in the business, not of buzzing around on the Western Front doing aerobatics, but he's very much in the business of killing other men. So the Germans do indeed laud, Richthofen, or they come to laud him as a national hero. But I think you and I would struggle to sit down and have a conversation with such a guy hell-bent on killing other men. I mean, spare a thought to the end of Jack Hay, of No. 40 Squadron, the Australian, plummeting from the sky at 500 metres. I think that's the harsh reality of it. Richthofen was certainly very good at what he did, but it certainly didn't make him a likable person.
You mentioned the cups that are in the collection of the museum in New Zealand, and I want to talk about the items in the Australian War Memorials collection, some of which I've seen. I have to say about the Red Baron, when I growing up in West Wyalong, I have to say that there was I remember an old veteran there showing me that his dad had brought him, he had a little piece of cloth in a frame, and that my dad cut this off the Red Baron on the Somme and off the Red Baron's plane. I tell you what, given the number of relics that come from this plane, it must have been massive. The sheer volume of relics that are purported to come from Richthofen's plane. So I think we should also start by saying that I assume a large quantity of things that say this definitely came from Richthofen's plane, that there's no way they could have. Is that a fair assessment?
Oh, yeah, look, we never say never. I mean, all these things are worthy of examination, but I think you're right. I mean, as time went on, Richthofen becomes quite well known within Germany. He's awarded the Pour le Mérite. He's given as he becomes the squadron commander of Jasta II. And you know, he starts painting his aircraft bright red and becomes the leading German air ace of the war. I think that, fast forward 100 years, and that every sort of piece of red fabric purporting to be from an airman, German airman, from the Western Front is allegedly from Richthofen. It says something about Richthofen's notoriety and fame, so much so that every German airman that ever took to the skies in France and Belgium between 1916 to 18 has ultimately become subsumed or kind of been credited to Manfred von Richthofen. I mean, there's some objects in the Memorial's collection of lozenge-painted camouflage, which adorned some German aircraft in the latter stages of the war, that have been donated to the Memorial in the belief that they're from Richthofen's aircraft. And I can assure you they're not. There are gun sights, field artillery gun sights, which have been, again, been donated in the belief that they were souvenired from, it's the gun sight from Richthofen's aircraft. I can assure you that Richthofen didn't have any field artillery optics fitted to his Fokker triplane at that time. But somewhere along the line, there probably is a tenuous link between maybe Richthofen, the location of that particular individual, or the donor, or their particular soldier within their family, or even perhaps just a memory of this, of someone talking about Richthofen and this being relayed onwards. But at the fundamental thing, I don't think that we should be sort of denigrating people and who may be mistakenly in a belief in the fact that items that may be associated with the air war are linked to Richthofen, but it says something about Richthofen's fame of this time, which of course has transcended over the next 100 years. And just to kind of get up to speed and sort of get to Richthofen's, I guess, final flights, Richthofen's career soars afterwards. I mean, like I said, he is appointed, given command of Jasta II. He's awarded the Pour le Mérite, which he values quite highly. This is the Imperial Germany's top honor for bravery. He gets given command of Jagdgeschwader Ein, which is JG1. It's the Hunting Squadron Number 1. And this is a formation that allows Richthofen to command not one, but four fighter squadrons. He, by cherry picking the best and brightest of the fighter pilots the Germans have at that time. And they referred to the Jagdgeschwader Ein as the Flying Circus. And they very much travel in caravan via train to various parts of the German front to gain an aerial dominance over that particular front. And by June and July 1917, Richthofen is flying over Flanders, where in 6th of July 1917, he receives a head wound in an engagement with FE2s of No. 20 Squadron over Vervik in Belgium. And Richthofen makes a forced crash landing. His bullet has creased his forehead, he ultimately survives the engagement. But this is where I think Richthofen really starts to come undone. Physically, he has a bullet wound to the head, and it's some indication that perhaps that has caused a traumatic brain injury. But then also, too, I think also the strain of aerial combat at this time is really starting to show, and Richthofen becomes notably disinhibited from this point onwards, to the point where, whilst he was convalescing in Germany in October 1917, he laid his head on the dining table of a restaurant to display the gaping wound to his head. Now, that doesn't sound too aristocratic and aloof to me. That actually sounds like a guy who's really starting to struggle. He was more irritable, and he suffered from terrible headaches, and he really started to not pay attention to those pilot sort of axioms, those dicta bulka axioms of pilot success that he had kind of learnt his trade with, but then also was instilling in the pilots of Jagdgeschwader Ein. He returned to flying duties despite doctor's orders not to, and continues on to rack up a significant amount of kills. Not in his Red Fokker triplane. He's still flying Albatross Scouts during this time. by April 1918, at the end of the German Spring Offensive, his tally stood at 80. And it's worth to point out that the final 16 victories occurred over with a six-week period. Just in those final 6 weeks was when he was flying that Fokker triplane. So we've come to assume that Richthofen spent his entire career in Fokker triplanes, and it's only within the last 6 weeks of his life that he ultimately flies that the very famous machine that he's ultimately killed in.
It would be remiss of us not to talk about the flight that ended his life, his last flight. Let's do it briefly, because I think it's been overdone. I mean, in your notes, you said that too much has been written about the final chapter, but we should cover it briefly. So what happened to Richthofen at the end?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, and if I don't do this section of the story justice, you literally just need to go to a library and look at the aviation section of the First World War, and I can guarantee you there would be dozens of books on Richthofen's final flight. But needless to say that on the 21st of April 1918, whilst flying an all-red Fokker DR-1 with a serial number 42517, Richthofen was mortally wounded and made a forced landing near Vosges-Somme around 11 a.m. He had been locked in combat with Sopwith Camels flying from number 209 Squadron Royal Air Force, which the Royal Air Force at that time had recently formed from the Royal Flying Corps and the Royal Naval Air Service. He had been engaging a Sopwith Camel flown by a Canadian pilot by the name of Wilfred May, and Richthofen himself was being hotly pursued by Captain Arthur Brown, or Roy Brown, who was another Canadian. Now, Richthofen, around this time, he seems not to sort of get into the sort of re-examining the final flight too much, but I think it's really important to say that Richthofen appeared to suffer from an uncharacteristic episode of target fixation here, so much so that he was focused so much on Wat Mei in following him over the British front and low down the Somme Valley that he sort of lost sense of what else was happening around him. So Richthofen flies low along the River Somme over British lines and appeared at eye level to hundreds of Australian troops from the 3rd and 4th Australian Divisions who are dug in on Moreland Corps Ridge. What we know is that Richthofen is hit by a bullet that passed laterally through his chest. In fact, what we know is the fatal bullet crossed, it entered beneath Richthofen's armpit, right armpit, and then penetrated out below his left nipple. So we suggest that it was a ground shot, not a shot from behind that came from Brown. And Richthofen makes a controlled crash landing in a field along the Bray Corby Road, where ultimately he lands his aircraft and succumbs to his wounds almost immediately. We like to think that Richthofen had a long and distinguished flying career, and of course that's in some respects is measured by the fact he had 80 confirmed kills, but what Australians and the British troops referred to as the Red Falcon, was Manfred von Richthofen, he was finally down and dead at the age of just 25.
I should also say that when we go to the Western Front, I mean, you led tours to the Western Front, Aaron, and I get over there occasionally as well. That's a great spot to go to on the banks of the Somme, and it's a very picturesque spot, and is now marked as the spot where his plane came down. So we're fairly sure that he was now felled by Australians, aren't we, by that ground fire?
Yeah, I think convincing... Well, before I go on, I should probably say that the Royal Air Force gave Brown the credit of killing Richthofen. Number 209 Squadron RAF is still in existence, and if you have a look at its squadron crest, it actually is a red falcon falling from the sky in reference to Richthofen. So for many years, the British had believed that the Canadians who were serving within the Royal Flying Corps, the Royal Air Force, had believed that, you know, they had brought down Richthofen, and, you know, that's a worthy claim. But I think those who submitted claims, I think it's about six different people had submitted claims that they had brought down Richthofen. Mostly Australians, of course. Richthofen's squadron had actually been engaged with the twin seaters of number 3 Squadron AFC earlier that morning, and even some of the pilots and observers of that squadron even put in claims. Of course, it was later found to be not the case. And of course, a number of Australian ground troops, of course, submitted claims as well. So there has been a lot of debate and discussion, almost 100 years of it. I mean, more attention, more ink has been spilled debating who killed Richthofen than actually looking at the totality of his life. And I think the most convincing book that I've read is P.J. Caracella's book. I think it's Who Killed the Red Baron, or The Red Baron's Final Moments. It's a book from the 1960s, and he went around at a time interviewing a lot of the men of the 3rd and 4th Australian Divisions who put in who made substantial and very compelling evidence in not only just who brought down the Red Baron, but then also to what happened to his kit and equipment. So I'll just mention two people I should probably say that, you know, I think this debate over who killed Richthofen really comes down to the fact that Richthofen was such a worthy aerial opponent, and for many it seemed more fitting that Richthofen be brought down in aerial combat against a worthy opponent, another fighter pilot, than just simply blundering into a veritable storm of Australian ground fire. I mean, the fact that Richthofen, you know, is this leading fighter pilot and he was killed from a fatal bullet from the ground, it almost seems as though, it seems a little ignominious, I guess. It's sort of less heroic than the fact that Richthofen may have actually been brought down by another fighter pilot. But needless to say, I think there's two strong Australian cases of guys who may have been may have fired the fatal shot. Sergeant Cedric Popkin of the 24th Machine Gun Company, or Gunner Robert Buey of the 53rd Battery of the 14th Field Artillery Brigade. Both of these guys are anti-aircraft gunners. They're trained in deflection shooting, that is, leading the aircraft so that when you fire the round, it actually meets up with the aircraft at the more or less the right spot. And they're also fitted with anti-aircraft sights. But then also, too, there's also the possibility that any one of the thousands of Australians who were dug in on that position at that time could have shouldered their Lee Enfield rifles and engaged Richthofen as he flew low across the Australian front. They could have also been responsible for his death. But at the end of the day, we're never going to know. What we do know is that Richthofen was down. He was 25 years old, and certainly the Germany had lost one of their great national heroes at a very critical point in the war.
And just finally, mate, in the collection of the War Memorial, there's some things that we know are associated with Richthofen. What do you have in the collection that speaks to you about his life and death?
Yeah, sure. Well, certainly we have more objects in the collection that actually speak about his death, because, as you say, the Australians were on site when when his Red Fokker triplane is brought down, and they sort of basically shred the triplane down to its framework within a matter of about 15 minutes. We have a Carl Bamberg compass that was removed by Sergeant Harold Tench of the 41st Battalion, which is probably one of the more iconic objects. I think Tench was and men of the 41st Battalion were very conscious of the fact that that even though these objects may be submitted to the Australian War Records Section for keeping or for safe housing for what would ultimately be the Australian War Memorial, they may disappear as souvenirs on some officer's desk further up the chain of command. So the compass is a really good one. It actually talks about some of the technical pieces of kit that were fitted out within the Fokker triplane. We've got dozens of pieces of red fabric allegedly from Richthofen's aircraft, and I say that because we know that we have red fabric that's definitely from the aircraft, because it's been verified. In fact, conservators and some of our staff in the 1990s actually took a very close examination of the weave count of the genuine bona fide bits and pieces that have excellent provenance, so that we can then check that against fakes or stuff that isn't actually from Richthofen's aircraft. Pieces of web belt, ammunition belt, that's actually from the Spandau machine guns. There's great photographs of Australians, of men of number 3 Squadron, Australian Flying Corps, at Poulainville Aerodrome the following day after Richthofen was brought down, cradling these LMG machine guns. There's often the assumption that the Australian War Memorial has them. We don't, they're probably out there either in private collections or in a museum somewhere. Most distinctly, we have the Balkenkreuz, the Baltic crosses that were from Richthofen's wings and fuselage. We've got two of them in the collection, one of which is on display in the memorial's First World War Gallery. Of course, we have his field modified flying control column, which was specifically altered for Richthofen. It's interesting, there is a sort of a blip switch which whenever the pilot presses that switch, the engine cuts out, and that's a way in which pilots can easily throttle the aircraft and for tighter turns or for landing. Richthofen actually had his blip switch moved so it's offset close to his right thumb. And there's other some more minor variations. But of course, the control column itself has been smashed from the aircraft or from the crash itself, and that's currently also on display in the memorial's galleries. We have his fur-lined flying overboots, which were made out of what appears to be deer fur. Bearing in mind that pilots of the First World War were flying in open air cockpits, often at 10,000 feet. So things can get quite brisk in an open air cockpit. So these guys were all done up in leather jackets and scarves and fur-lined overboots. We've got both of them in the collection. One's in better state than the other. And those were taken off Richthofen's body by members of Number 3 Squadron just before he was buried by the Australians. There's also tons of little bits of aluminium and other little small fragments of wing strut that are purported to be from Richthofen. Of course, there's no way to determine whether a small piece of aluminium cut from the engine cowling or a piece of timber from an engine from one of those wing struts can be verified as being from Richthofen. So we actually look at the individual who may or may not have taken that. So in some cases, they're clearly identified as members of the third or fourth brigades. We know that the aircraft itself crashed not too far away from the 11th Brigade headquarters. So usually individuals associated with the 11th Brigade generally have fairly strong claims as well. The memorial has quite a number of objects that are verified as being from Richthofen. I've talked about some of those objects which have been donated in the belief that they were from Richthofen, but of course some clearly are not, and some may be, but there's no way to find out. One piece is a piece of red and white metal ribbon, which is consistent with that of the German second class Iron Cross, which was donated to the memorial in the belief that it was taken from Richthofen's uniform. It could be. We don't know. There's no way to find out. But there are also individuals who we know were involved in some things, such as the medical examination of Richthofen's body that was carried out at Poulainville Airfield just before he was buried by the Australians, full military honours, at near the Australian Australia Corps headquarters at Bertong. There's some bits and pieces, buckles and straps from Richthofen's flying overalls associated with key individuals who have been present for that medical examination. So there's a very strong link there. I want to, just by wrapping up in the collections that the memorial has, I want to talk about some of the fur-lined gloves that the memorial has in the collection that was believed to have been from Richthofen. These have been in the memorial's collection since the mid-1990s, and they are of a private purchase Royal Flying Corps trigger pattern pair of gloves, which are said to have been from Richthofen. Our conservators very quickly discovered that the fur was kangaroo fur, and they were indeed British gloves. We know that Richthofen took trophies from his victims, such as that of Lano Hawker. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility that these could be the real deal. But eyewitnesses who are present at the crash site and who describe some of the objects and items that Richthofen had on him at the time talk about a black pair of gloves. And in fact, some of that testimony is very inconsistent. Some say the gloves went to 11th Brigade headquarters. Some say the gloves went to a sergeant who alleged to have brought down Richthofen. So, what's the real deal? Digging through the collection notes, we realize that the gloves were from an individual of Number 3 Squadron, who had played a key role in mounting the guard over Richthofen's body and aircraft. A chap by the name of Sergeant Joseph Knapp. Knapp had given these gloves to a friend, and the friend's daughter had been the donor. And the donor said that her father had reskinned the gloves in kangaroo fur because the original otter fur, which would appear that the gloves were made out of some sort of black fur, they had deteriorated to such a state that they had to recover them in kangaroo fur in an attempt to restore them from their former glory. Knapp appears in Carousella's book that I mentioned previously, and he makes no mention of any of the items that he himself may have obtained from Richthofen. And I'm have to say that Carousella became one of the key collectors of Richtofen material. He is the bona fide Richtofen boffin of the 1960s, that he had amassed such a collection that when he passed away, a lot of the Richtofen material that's now flooded into various collections all around the world have come from the Carosella collection. So Carosella didn't catch on to the fact that Knapp may have actually had these gloves, which ultimately made their way into the memorial. Are they the real deal? Are they not? We don't know, but certainly there's evidence both ways. The best we can say that these gloves may potentially have been from Richtofen, but we just don't know for sure.
Mate, just a fascinating story. All those elements of it just make it even more enriching. Thank you for taking the time. I assume at times you get a bit sick of talking about the Red Baron, so thank you for taking the time. It's been really wonderful to hear your thoughts on it.
Oh, look, it's my pleasure to come back on the show, but I never get tired of talking about these things because often behind myths and legends, there are real individuals behind them. And certainly those people, I mean, Richtofen, there's more to Richtofen's 25 years than just the way in which he met his death. And I think that if anybody is interested in learning a little bit more about Richtofen and the research that I've been doing into him, I wrote an article for a German history magazine run in the UK called Iron Cross Magazine. In the most recent issue, I wrote an article called Red Falcon Relics, looking at the stories and objects behind some of the memorial's collection items relating to Richtofen, also showcasing some of those items that we have from Second Lieutenant Jack Hay of No. 40 Squadron, who was Richtofen's 17th aerial victim.
Brilliant stuff, mate. I'd encourage everyone to get down to the War Memorial and check out those items for themselves. Also, check out that article in Iron Cross magazine. And as always, Aaron, just a pleasure to catch up. Thank you so much for your time.
My absolute pleasure, Matt. Thank you very much for having me on the show yet again.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.